This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 102.7 in Gauteng and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Well, thank you to Chris Gilmore for steering the ship last night in my absence. Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo, and Raymond Parsons, Head of the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, are in studio for your weekly wrap and market view. Warwick, kick us off. Is this bull dying of old age anytime soon?
Well, I suppose not if Chairman Powell has anything to do with it, it would seem. I mean, in his testimony to Congress, I mean, we're looking at a situation where he all but said, well, there's going to be cuts, didn't he? What was particularly interesting there, though, was the comments about rebasing their views on what constitutes full employment. I mean, the old chestnut used to be that it was 5%, and if you ducked under 5% unemployment, I should say, and if you ducked under that, you started getting inflationary pressures. Well, I mean, they've been kicking it around at 3-something for the last 9 months at least, and still no inflationary pressures. So, I mean, he's right to say, well, there's possibly grounds to revisit that, and it's an important reset, I think.
A very important reset. The missing inflation, Raymond, we see record amounts of money flowing now into junk bonds that are yielding negative rates. So basically, is paying to hold junk. I mean, really, is a topsy-turvy world we're living in.
Well, yes, and I think that's why it's quite interesting if you unpack what... you know what Powell has said. He's almost become a sort of world central banker now because he's been quite worried about where the world economy is going. I think it's also a lesson in a way. The Fed has backed itself into a corner now. It really has no choice but at least to offer some kind of cut at the end of this month. But I think the point. I think why I'm a little bit uneasy because of the mixed signals is that firstly. If you unpack the evidence of what's happening in the U.S. economy, it's still very strong and very positive. And I think one has to acknowledge that. And I think if there's to be a downturn, you may say, well, you shouldn't do something until you see the whites of its eyes, as it were. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I'm worried about what I would call a perverse incentive. Given the damage done through the trade policies of the White House to the world economy and the potential there, are we now saying that the US Fed must now, each time the White House does something wrong, which is damaging, must then jump in and it must adjust monetary policy for that reason? I raise a question because you're then encouraging the White House to go on, say, well, as long as we do these things, someone will, in fact, they will compensate for what we're doing. And there was an interesting CNN business survey yesterday among a business audience where they asked the question, do you think the time is ripe now to, in fact, cut U.S. interest rates? And the response was 75% no and 25% yes. So I think the point I'm just saying, it probably... they've backed themselves into a corner now. They will have to do something at the end of the month. But I would have been inclined to keep my powder dry for a little longer until I get more certainty about where the world economy is going and how much room I've got on the monetary side. I think the IMF is right to tell other governments, like in Europe, you must use fiscal policy. Don't expect a magic wand from monetary policy. And I think that is still very true of the United States as it is of other parts of the world.
Thanks, Raymond. Warwick, it raises an interesting point about the speech and what was said. We live in increasingly uncertain times. The Fed mentioned the word uncertain 22 times in the latest minute. Mm. So that really just reaffirms what Raymond is saying. Very difficult to make big policy decisions when we do live in such uncertain times. And one of the key indicators of the health of the global economy came out this morning in China's exports and import numbers. They both fell in June. So obviously the higher tariffs in the U.S. trade war is certainly having an impact there. But I'd like to look at where Trump is aiming his guns now. He's upping the ante against French proposals to tax big tech up 3% of turnover. His most senior trade official looking at retaliatory tariffs over there. And we know he's rather fond of tariffs, is our tangerine man. Maybe the EU will be next. What impact do you see this escalation of tariffs having on global growth?
Okay, so I think in terms of Trump, I mean, you know, bear in mind that he came in promising to be a reformer, and he promised to be a very aggressive, busy reformer. And one certainly can't take it away from it, love him or hate him, that he has been busy. When it comes to the whole process now that we're seeing with the French tax on the likes of Facebook or other tech companies, it's actually part of a much bigger rolling brawl, which is that essentially the EU wanted as a combined bloc to come up with some kind of taxation framework for all of these big global tech companies that were obviously active in their countries, but certainly not really reporting all the proceeds there. I mean, in the case of Google, for example, I think it all gets channeled via a Luxembourg company. So, I mean, they're selling a service into these economies and they're not paying tax on it. And I think in most parts of the EU, there's some aggravation about that.
Different structures, the double Dutch, Irish, and all of those
things. Etc. There's many of them. But from France's point of view, their attitude was, well, right, we're going to tax this lot, and when and if there's an international agreement that comes together, we will then slipstream into that, and thanks for coming. And I mean, it's not just France that's looking at this, by the way. I mean, the UK has teed itself up to put in a similar turnover type taxation in for 2020. So it's not a unique situation here at all.
Raymond, I'd like you to jump in just after this quick break. We need to find out what's happening out on the roads with Katleho after this quick break.
You're listening to Classic Business with Michael Avery, brought to you by Altron, there when it matters.
Welcome back. With your view from the market is Warwick Lucas, CIO of Galileo Asset Management, and Professor Raymond Parsons from the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Raymond, the global trade order has been shifting for some time. And as this happens, we see Africa almost breaking ranks with the rest of the world and signing this African Continental Free Trade Area. Is it a lot of political hot air? Is there real opportunity in this? How do you view it?
Well, I must say I've been trying to monitor this. It's not a bailing out from the world order. There are free trade agreements within the World Trade Organization. There is provision for that. And in fact, many countries operate on this basis. So it's not breaking down the multilateral system.
Well, I'm just saying, as the rest of the world is raising tariff barriers, here we are talking about free trade.
Yes, but the EU still wants to preserve its rules and wants to maintain a multilateral view. And the same if you look at Asia. So I would say that this African free trade area has the potential in the long term to be an absolute game changer for the continent. And I say long term because I want to emphasize why you have to start now. You have to make sure that some of the building blocks are in place. There have been some deadlines set. One is for next January, where certain items have to be identified as being worthy of, in fact, having to cut tariffs. And then there's a five-year view for what I'd call the more developed aspects of Africa, and a 10 to 15-year view for the poorer parts of Africa. Now, I think that's important that it should be phased. There are things beyond trade that will have to create an enabling environment for trade to succeed. We know what those are: infrastructure, visa requirements, border requirements. That's all part of the package. I think you're quite right to say we must understand that this has been driven primarily politically and bureaucratically, so there's a lot of political enthusiasm and there are some economic realities that have to be managed. My point is that there's a great advantage for South Africa as one of the more developed economies on the continent once this thing starts to take shape. But we must get in early, in the sense that our business community must engage with the Department of Trade and Industry. I often say that the Department of Trade and Industry would be better named the Department for Trade and Industry. But what should happen is that our business community must now engage with the DTI and say, look, we want this to work. We see lots of opportunities over time. We want this to succeed. How do we engage to get the balanced outcomes? There are some decisions to be taken by January. There are some decisions to be taken the following year. Because unfortunately, we've had previous great visions for the region and for the continent that have been devised by the politicians at a conference, and the potential has simply been destroyed because nothing happened. The air went out of the balloon and nothing happened. This is a serious opportunity by more than 50 countries in Africa to have a game-changing arrangement on trade, and I think that our business community must make sure that they're part of this process, they make their inputs, because after all, whatever framework you decide, it's the business people with their animal spirits that have to make it happen. So I think it's tremendously important that now that this thing has been launched, there are some deadlines, let's ensure that our private sector is fully engaged to make sure that the future decisions are not only the correct ones to enhance the chances of this being a success, but above all, that the conditions for that success, which go beyond trade, will also be facilitated, and that there won't be in 2 or 3 years' time huge recriminations as to who let the side down.
Doesn't help that there are strikes at our ports as we talk about this here in South Africa, Raymond. But Warwick, just to bring you in on that conversation, business really has to be part of the conversation here. MTN is present all across Africa. I'm going to be chatting to Rob Shooter in a short while. We know ShopRite has a great presence in the rest of Africa. Earlier today at a private equity conference I was facilitating at Gibbs, African infrastructure investment managers were talking about their operations in West Africa. They're just getting a toehold in Egypt. So we have a great wealth of experience in South Africa in the business community that is waiting to be tapped. Do you think this is the time for business to go out and knock on government's door, wait for government to come to it?
Well, I think it's got to be proactive. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. Government has got a hell of a lot of issues on its plate right now. Getting power sorted out, or Eskom as a large entity, is one factor. The other factor is, of course, getting power back into our grid, which we are going to see probably come through via small power producers feeding into the grid. I mean, there's, you know, we saw some revisions to legislation there a while back that will be quite helpful in terms of bringing new power producers into the grid, and heaven knows we need it to succeed. But yeah, I mean, alternatively, you know, looking at the kind of results that are coming through, well, they are just absolutely horrid, and it's quite clear that South African managers are, if they are running a tight ship at the moment, they really have limited expansion possibilities in the domestic market. So the alternative for growth is indeed to look outside.
Yeah, and we are running perilously close to the edge of the cliff. If you look at the amount of retrenchments that are starting to come through, ArcelorMittal 2000 announced this week, thanks to the cost of electricity prices, we're now imposing a carbon tax as well. That all brings me back, Raymond, to the role of monetary policy in all of this, and certainly monetary policy is not the answer to our structural issues in South Africa, but a slightly lower interest rate would certainly help the cost of funding for businesses and help spur a consumer that, judging by Woolies' numbers, might just be on the edge of turning around somewhat. What do you make of the reappointment of the Saab governor and the elevation to the deputy role of Dr. Kassim and the previous economic advisor?
Well, I think there are two points I would make. I think firstly, one is very pleased, you know, with this appointment. Firstly, broadly, it sends a strong message that the independence of the Reserve Bank is going to be upheld and reinforced. I think that's very important after this huge debate and this huge controversy that we've had in the recent months from a political point of view about the mandate of the bank and quantitative easing and what its status and its role should be. By putting this team in place, I think that message has gone out very strongly as to how we see the whole role of the bank, and I think it's a well-qualified team, and I think one can say monetary policy is in safe hands, and I think that's what's important. Now, coming to the monetary policy meeting next week, I'm expecting, both from a global and a domestic point of view, that we will see a cut in interest rates. I've said before, if I had a vote on the MPC, that's how I would vote. Because whatever we say about the status, the role, and the respect for the bank doesn't rule out that one interrogates their decisions. And from time to time, one may think they might have made a mistake. Even central banks make mistakes. And when you're independent, you have the right to make a mistake now and again. As long as there is transparency and accountability and engagement. So I'm certainly hoping that we'll see a cut next week. But I also want to emphasize that although it's a useful, supportive step, justified by the circumstances, that it probably would have quite a bigger psychological effect than the actual cut. Don't look for the heavy lifting in South Africa from our monetary policy. Don't be distracted. And that's what this whole debate about the bank unfortunately did do. It seemed to indicate that the bank was a Father Christmas somehow, who would bring all sorts of gifts of growth and employment. That is not what it can do, but it can play a useful supportive role, and I think there is room for us to be able to bring down interest rates. I would just warn people that even if it comes down by, say, a 25 basis points, that will only put us back to where we were last November. But nonetheless, don't look to monetary policy to deal with issues that should be dealt with by ESCOM or by infrastructure or by delivery issues. That's the real agenda for the country, and we must look only to the Reserve Bank to preserve our financial stability and to strengthen investor confidence.
Speaking about ESCOM and the PIC, obviously the rumor mill is that we'll see some kind of debt for equity swap, which I think is actually quite a nice way of aligning civil servants' interests behind the ailing power utility and ensuring that everyone understands full well what the Zuma years did to ESCOM. It'll be interesting to see exactly how the election of the chairman goes. That position seems to have been depoliticized as well, which I think once again sends a very clear signal, at least to the business community, that we're trying to break from the past and the dark days of state capture. Did the appointments at the Saab and the PIC improve your mood around SA Inc., or are you still feeling full Magnus about the future of the country? Tweet us at Classic1027 or send us your telegram on 066-470-1872.